This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on December 5th, 2013. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Federal Election Commission for Thursday, December 5th, 2013 will now come to order. I want to offer a special welcome to three visitors that we have here today as part of the Bethesda Chevy Chase High School Career Day program. So welcome to Joseph Levine, Harry Damodaran, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and Julia Madison. Both of my daughters graduated. Mm-hmm. Yes, hi, it's nice to see you. I had nothing to do with your being here, but both of my daughters graduated from BCC. Go Barons, glad to have you. Now, on to the actual agenda, which starts off with the correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman, do you have a motion?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt agenda document number 13-53-A, minutes for the open session held on October 31, 2013.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of the minutes for the meeting of October 31st, 2013, as set forth in agenda document number 13-53A. Is there any discussion on the motion? If not, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries, 6-0. The next item on the agenda is the draft interpretive rule regarding date of political party nominations of candidates for special primary elections in New York. This is a document that we mentioned at the last meeting, put out on the public agenda, and gave the public an opportunity to comment, and now it's back. Does council have anything to say?
Just that we received no comments on the draft, and the next step in the process would be for the commission to approve the draft for publication in the Federal Register, and if that occurs, we would ask for authority to make any necessary technical and conforming amendments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the draft?
Madam Chair, I just want to highlight a sentence that was important to me in reviewing this on page 4, lines 5 to 8. And that was just the statement, and I appreciate the statement, to the extent that other states' nominating procedures for special elections are materially indistinguishable from those of New York, the commission anticipates this interpretation would apply to such other states as well. I think that's an important statement. I also want to emphasize, having worked in elections in various states, different states and different nominating procedures follow different patterns. Some are tiered, where the final decision on who gets nominated can go through multiple stages of local canvasses or regional canvasses, then a state convention to choose delegates, and then a primary after that. So I think that's just an important aspect of this that we need to note and keep in mind.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Any other comments? Or perhaps we're ready for a motion. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Madam Chair, I move that the Commission approve agenda document 13-48, notice of interpretive rule regarding the date of political party nominations of candidates for special primary elections in New York, and authorize the Office of General Counsel to make any conforming technical edits as necessary.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of agenda document number 13-48, the draft interpretive rule regarding date of political party nominations of candidates for special primary elections in New York, my home state. Want things to be clear there. And to authorize counsel to make technical and conforming changes. Any discussion on the motion? If not, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes, 6-0. Thank you, Ms. Hensel. The next item on the agenda is the let me just mention that the item after this, the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Caesars Entertainment Corporation Political Action Committee, that was put on the agenda because some commissioners had some concerns, wanted a little bit more time to look at it. Those concerns have been resolved and it's all been approved, so we're not going to have any discussion today of that matter at the table, but the recommendation was approved. So, going back to number three, the draft advisory opinion 2013-19 from Yamaha Motor Corporation. I understand Mr. Tyson, Yamaha's lawyer, is on the phone.
Mr. Tyson, this is Sean Worth. Are you with us?
I am. Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning. I'm going to kick the volume up.
That would be helpful. Welcome, Mr. Tyson. We'll let you know if we have any questions for you. And we'll begin with a presentation from counsel. Mr. Atkins.
Good morning. Agenda document 13-51 contains two advisory opinions that respond to a request submitted on behalf of Yamaha Motor Corporation. Yamaha asks whether it may solicit contributions to its SSF from the executive and administrative personnel of its marine divisions, dealers, and service centers. Drafts A and B reach opposite conclusions on whether such solicitations would be consistent with the Act and Commission regulations. Draft A concludes that solicitations would be impermissible because Yamaha is not affiliated with its dealers and service centers. Draft B concludes that the solicitations would be lawful because Yamaha exercises sufficient control over the dealers and service centers such that they would be affiliated. If either draft is adopted, we would, of course, ask for the authority to make technical and conforming changes. There were no comments on either the draft, on either the request or the drafts, and we're happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Is there any discussion on the drafts or questions for either our counsel or Mr. Tyson? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These affiliation analyses are always fact-intensive inquiries where we're determining whether or not two organizations are affiliated for purposes of whether or not they may solicit the restricted class of an organization that is determined to be affiliated. And in these cases where we're looking at agreements between franchisors and franchisees or between manufacturers and dealers or other similar arrangements, we look to the examine the extent to which such agreements between those entities affect the independence of the franchisees or the dealers or the other related organization, and by independence meaning to what extent do those agreements impair the status of that other group to operate as an independent business. One of our more recent advisory opinions, the Duncan Brands advisory opinion, looked at a number of factors, and one of the ones that was identified in that advisory opinion was the exclusivity agreement. That is, that the Dunkin' Donuts franchises could only sell Dunkin' Donuts. They couldn't go get Krispy Kremes or anything else. There was the exclusivity non-compete agreement, and exclusivity does provide evidence of a direction or control that would be sufficient to demonstrate that that the franchisee's status as an independent business is affected and would be considered, I think the language that we've used in other advisory opinions is significantly impaired. But exclusivity is not necessarily dispositive. If it were, it would probably be listed as one of the factors in our regulations, which looks at the question of affiliation. It can be found at Section 11 CFR, Section 100.5G, that lists a number of factors. Exclusivity isn't one of them, but not to say it is an important one, but it's not the only one. So in looking at the Duncan Brands advisory opinion, where we did say that there was the Duncan Brands and their franchisees were affiliated for purposes of the Act, and therefore Duncan Brands could solicit the restricted classes of those franchisees, and compare that to the facts as we have them presented before us in Yamaha. When you examine the training requirements, the quality controls, the business operation standards, the controls over the use of trademarks, the controls over the marketing, in this case, dealing with Yamaha, those standards, controls, requirements are every bit as extensive, if not more so, than they were in Duncan Brands. In this case, there is an exclusivity. The dealers or service centers aren't bound to only sell or service Yamaha outboard motors. However, that doesn't end the inquiry. We then have to look at the key question, which is, are there other elements to these agreements that otherwise significantly impair the independence of these dealers and service centers? And one of the things that I look at is the ability of Yamaha to veto ownership changes, any changes in other key personnel at these dealers, and also their ability to veto any location changes that a dealer may want to undertake. When I look at the regulation, one of the factors that is enumerated is Section 100.5G, 4, 2 little I, capital C, if you want to follow that string of sites, where it says one of the factors for finding affiliation is whether a sponsoring organization or committee has the authority or ability to hire, appoint, demote, or otherwise control the officers or other decision-making employees or members of another sponsoring organization or committee. And I think the veto that Yamaha has in this and as part of their arrangements with their dealers and service centers does demonstrate that authority to be able to impact their ownership and their other key personnel. And if I could just ask one question of Yamaha's counsel, are you still with us on the phone?
Yes, Commissioner, I am.
Okay. One of the statements that caught my eye in the request that you set forward was that while the agreements between Yamaha and its dealers and service centers aren't formally exclusive, it sounds like the nature of these agreements results in many cases in, if I can use the term, functional exclusivity. Is that is that a correct read of your representation?
Yes, Commissioner, and it's one of the features of the marine industry that your volume generally, unless you're right on the water, for example, in Florida, is going to be low enough that you can't necessarily just sell one brand, but most dealers self-identify primarily with a brand. And so I think functional exclusivity may be a way to think about it, that dealers are going to be identified by the public and by themselves really as a primary dealer, primarily identified with a particular brand, in this case, Yamaha, for most of our dealers.
Okay. I appreciate that that confirmation. To me, when you see that that result as a consequence of these agreements, to me that does demonstrate the sort of pervasive control over dealers and service centers that in other advisory opinions the commission has determined was sufficient to establish affiliation. And as I said earlier, I think that those sorts of arrangements do demonstrate that whatever independence that these dealers and service centers otherwise have are significantly impaired by these. One other thing I'd also mention is not only do you have your, the various requirements and quality controls, one other thing that was mentioned in the request was that you have a district marketing manager who does quarterly visits to ensure that all of those controls and standards and requirements are being met. Is that correct?
That is correct, and on occasion, those district marketing managers will visit more often than quarterly. They have to visit at least quarterly, but it's generally more often than that.
Okay. And I don't know if in the other cases that happens in other franchise or franchisee advisory opinions. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. It hasn't been noted, but it has. And so maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But in this case, there actually is a mechanism. There's actually a process and an individual to ensure that the all of those requirements within the agreements are actually being carried out. So again, I think that when taking into account the totality of the facts as we have them presented before us, I think that this does demonstrate again the key question is answered, I think, in the affirmative that the independence of the dealers in the service center are significantly impaired in these instances, I think sufficiently to determine that they are affiliated with Yamaha, and that therefore Yamaha's SSF should be able to solicit the restricted classes of these class of dealers and service centers, and that's the view that's reflected in draft B that's before us, and at the appropriate time I will support that draft.
Thank you, Commissioner Peterson. Do we have further comments? Mr. Vice Chairman?
Just one, just alert on draft B. I just have one edit to make, and that's in footnote 1 of page 1 of draft B. And it's just a technical wording change in the second sentence. The sentence currently reads, the commission was unable to approve a response to that request by the required 4 affirmative votes. And I'm going to propose an edit to that to say the commission was unable to render an opinion in response to that request by the required four affirmative votes.
Thank you for the clarification. Further discussion? I'll just say that this question has been before us before, or a substantially similar question has been before us before about a year ago. Haven't really changed my view since then. The affiliation analysis in draft A more closely reflects my view of the relationship between Yamaha and the dealers here. You know, it's a meeting that could make a person hungry because we're trying to figure out whether this is more analogous to the Dunkin' Donuts AO or the Anheuser-Busch AO. So maybe it might make some people thirsty. I don't know. But I think that it is more closely analogous to the Anheuser-Busch AO, more like a standard arrangement, contractual arrangement that many commercial entities have with the folks who sell their products. I do think the exclusivity or the lack thereof in this case is an important factor. Having said all that, I'm not going to actually be voting for draft A. There's sort of the sub silencio question in that underlies draft A, which I appreciate that the requester didn't ask this time, probably thought that that might be the key to getting a different answer this time if they didn't directly raise the question of whether the wholly owned subsidiary of a foreign corporation can actually establish an SSF. This is a topic that the Commission has dealt with in the past, but not since CU. And I think that the larger topic of the role of foreign-owned subsidiaries in the post-CU world, post-Citizens United world, is one that we really would be well advised to address in the rulemaking context. But failing that, I would be loath to support a draft from which the answers to that those questions might be implied, even though it's not directly addressed. So I'm trying not to give you an answer you don't want to a question you didn't ask, Mr. Tyson. But it is somewhat buried underneath there, and I thought I should probably at least mention it. Further discussion, Commissioner Walton.
Madam Chair, I support your comments. My vote would be pretty much the same as it was a year ago, and it was in December of 2012 when we asked for an advisory opinion on the same question, whether Yamaha's yet to be established SSF could solicit contributions from the executive and administrative personnel of Yamaha's non-exclusive dealers and service centers. In that advisory opinion request, Yamaha had also asked the prerequisite question of whether it was permissible for Yamaha as a domestic corporate subsidiary of a foreign-owned parent to establish an SSF in the first place. At the December 20th, 2012 open session, I expressed my concerns about Yamaha and any other domestic subsidiary of a foreign parent, for that matter, establishing an SSF, especially after the Supreme Court had determined in Citizens United that corporations could use their own corporate funds for independent political expenditures, with the consequence being that there is now a serious risk of funds coming from foreign sources impermissibly making their way into our political system. I would mention that we've, as far back as January 2000, we made a public draft notice of proposed rulemaking, which I supported, that had over 20 pages addressing the impact of Citizens United decision on the Act's foreign national prohibition and inviting public comments on the issue. We have yet to act on this. And right on draft A of that NPRM, we said on page 84, because U.S. corporations, as a result of Citizens United holding, may use their own treasury funds to make independent expenditures and disbursements for electioneering communications, the Commission now must examine for the first time the restrictions of 2 U.S.C. 441E and their potential application to political activities paid for by U.S. subsidiaries of foreign nationals or corporations. So until we're able to reach some conclusion on some of those issues that have been raised, I think it's premature for us to try and, especially in view of the fact that this matter has already been before us, to try and reach the second question that was presented over a year ago.
Commissioner Rappel?
I do not have the history that you all had with respect to this matter, and I only found out late last night that the previous request for an AO included the question about whether or not a foreign corporation could establish, or a subsidiary of a foreign corporation could establish an SSF. And I, too, agree, knowing that, that it would be inappropriate to vote on this matter today, to approve this matter, either one of the drafts, given the significance of that question. And I would urge us to look at rulemaking so that that would be preliminary to making any kinds of decisions in this case.
Any further comments, discussion, questions? Or perhaps someone wants to make a motion. Commissioner Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a comment. I don't know if counsel would know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway. How long is the commission, when did the commission first issue an opinion regarding domestic subsidiaries of foreign corporations and their permissibility to have a separate segregated fund?
I don't recall exactly, Commissioner, but I believe it went pretty far back into the commission's history.
Sorry, Mr. Tyson, we don't mean to be laughing at you, but Commissioner Peterson was actually looking at our counsel.
Yeah. Oh, I'm very sorry about that.
I should have had your guidance there as well.
But, I wouldn't have. If you had known that, then I would have really been impressed. I just wanted to ask our counsel, Mr. Adkins,
The list of AOs is pretty long that addresses this issue. The earliest ones that we've looked at least for the purpose of this AO, go back to 1980.
And as you mentioned, there have been numerous AOs. I don't know if we would be able to have an estimate of the number of SSFs that have been established in the wake of those AOs that have been continuous. I'd imagine it's hundreds, thousands, probably. And this was a well-known legal principle when McCain-Feingold was being debated back in 2002. It did not disturb this. We had a rule, the McCain-Feingold law did not alter this. And then when were the subsequent rulemakings that were that took place in their wake, actually considered this question, and there was nothing in our rules to disturb that. And in fact, I think that the evidence indicated, and certainly the comments indicated, that that congressional silence in that instance, in effect, blessed the pre-existing legal structure that had been in place. And and the commission's subsequent actions, we've had for AOs since then that have further reaffirmed the principle that domestic subsidiaries of foreign parents can establish SSFs. And the only thing that's changed is Citizens United, which liberalized the ability of corporations to engage in political speech in connection with federal elections. And in some ways, I think the foreign funding is a little bit of a red herring in that these are SSFs. We're talking about hard money. We're not talking about, I mean, the issue about whether or not SSFs can accept corporate or labor funds into what we call a carry account, that's the subject of litigation right now. But as these organizations that have had SSFs, we're dealing with hard money from, so that are subject to the limits and prohibitions of the Act. I find it troubling that in the course of an AO. Now, if we need to reconsider this in light of Citizens United, I mean, those are I'm not saying those aren't legitimate questions to ask, and maybe there is interest in some quarters of reconsidering the way that we're going to deal with domestic subsidiaries, and maybe there need to be different controls put in place or reassurances about when we would allow them to establish SSFs. But in the course of an AO where, again, there's been no legislative change, and the only intervening legal change was a case that specifically declined to opine on the issue of any foreign involvement or the foreign contributor ban. I've got to say that I think that may send out some troubling signals to the regulated community about how the commission is going to handle these going forward. I mean, if we need to do it, I think we should do it through rulemaking. But until that time, I think we need to reaffirm the decades-old and, as far as I can tell, undisturbed pattern of how we treat domestic subsidiaries of foreign parents. I'll just leave it at that.
I have a couple questions.
Certainly, Mr. Vice.
I wasn't aware of this debate.
Sorry, Mr. Vice Chairman. It's been simmering under the surface for quite a while.
Okay. But let me just, with counsel, Mr. Atkins, just ask you a couple basic questions just so I kind of understand. I understand Citizens United opened up a lot of cans of worms and to be debated. But when we're talking about a separate segregated fund, just on just getting some basic principles down, a domestic subsidiary of a foreign corporation could sponsor an SSF going back as far as, what, 1980?
At least, yes.
At least. Okay. And an SSF is a hard money account that can accept, what, only money from U.S. citizens?
Correct.
So no foreign citizen can donate to a separate segregated fund? I'm sorry, Mr.
Mr. Noddy, do you want to
comment? Citizen or permanent resident.
Thank you, yes. So the money into the PAC or the SSF can only come from U.S. citizens? So when the... Was that a yes?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. Just for the record. So when the SSF makes a contribution to a candidate in the United States, we're assured that only money that came from U.S. citizens is passed through the PAC to a U.S. U.S. campaign.
That's the understanding, yes.
Okay. And what is... Maybe the chair, I don't mean to put you on the spot, or maybe you can help illuminate, what's the argument for how Citizens United threatened U.S. elections with foreign dollars?
Let me save counsel from as he leans back gratefully away from the mic. I appreciate the argument that SSFs are the money that is donated through SSFs is all money that was contributed by U.S. citizens, and I don't contest that at all. The issue that I think is of concern to some of us is that an SSF can accept administrative support from the corporation. And that is deemed not to be a contribution. And I think before Citizens United, many commissioners, myself included, would not have been overly concerned about whatever small leakage of foreign-controlled money potentially, perhaps, could have been subsidizing through the administrative costs the SSFs, because it was really the most of the money that would be in play, and all the money that would be subsequently contributed would be money that was contributed by U.S. citizens. I don't contest any of that. However, this underlying that is the assumption that the administrative support is not a contribution and is appropriate coming from the corporation. We, post Citizens United, there are now brand new avenues for corporate support in American elections, which really raises the ante dramatically on the question of what is the role of foreign-owned subsidiaries, and can they in any way support political activity in this country. And we know that the foreign national ban stands post-Citizens United, although some people have argued that it is inconsistent. There is a very strong protective instinct, I think, on the part of our legislators and on the part of our courts that we don't want foreign money trying to influence our elections. In light of this whole new world of corporate money that is now allowed to enter the political fray in the United States, some of us have serious concerns about any opinion that could, by implication, suggest that the corporate money of the subsidiary of a wholly owned foreign corporation is okay in American elections in any way, shape, or form. We think this is an issue that really needs to be flushed out in the rulemaking context. Commissioner Peterson's entirely right. McCain-Feingold didn't touch this issue, but Citizens United really does, for some of us, raise some very important issues about the role of foreign money in U.S. elections and what kind of protections we need to have in place to ensure that the foreign national ban is preserved and protected, that we think really needs to be addressed in a rulemaking context. So it's really it's not so much the SSF and the money that the SSF would be spending that is of concern. It's the further implications of this, and this would be the first time post Citizens United that the commission would have weighed in on this issue.
I can see the journalists enjoying this discussion,
somewhat redundant of the discussion that we had a year ago. So the journalists can go back and look at their old notes, and they'll find the same arguments back then.
But let me just understand what I'm sensing: a bit of a non sequitur, which is Citizens United didn't speak to the issue of a U.S. domestic subsidiary's administrative overhead to run an SSF. It spoke to corporations being able to make independent expenditures. So I'm just trying to understand the leap from Citizens United to rethinking 30 years or more of acceptability of domestic subsidiaries sponsoring an SSF that's only going to pass U.S. dollars into U.S. campaigns. Since Citizens United didn't speak to administrative costs of SSFs, didn't speak to contributions at all, I'm just trying to get over that logical, I'm trying to find the logical link in the syllogism about why Citizens United somehow implicated or upset the administrative sponsoring costs for SSFs.
What Citizens United did speak to was the role of corporate money in American politics. And at the same time, we know from other case law that there was no intention to upset the foreign national, the ban on foreign money coming into U.S. elections. The administrative costs of setting up an SSF by a corporation, while, some might argue that's de minimis, it's still money that comes from the corporation and that is subsidizing U.S. political activity. And some might argue, I'd be happy to learn that nobody would argue this, but I bet somebody would, that the implication of our continuing to allow U.S. subsidiaries of foreign-owned corporations to subsidize political activities through the SSF, through the administrative costs of the SSS, some would argue that the implication of that would be that they could also directly spend money in U.S. elections. Now, some might not, but I'm pretty sure some would. And I think there's a reluctance on some of our parts to open that door. Again, we'd be happy to engage in this discussion in a rulemaking context and sort of flesh out whether these are even concerns that we ought to be worried about. But I have, unfortunately, too often seen small decisions that appear to be confined to their facts then being used as the basis for more expansive interpretations once they are adopted by the commission. So I think that's the concern.
Fair point, and I understand, I guess, in having to vote today. I guess my concern with the argument is that you're really making sort of a slippery slope argument. And while I can appreciate slippery slope arguments, there is sort of, from my logic class in college, just because idea B is a bad idea doesn't make idea A a bad idea. And I'm failing to see the direct linkage between what has historically been a fair practice that has not raised problems now being rethought in light of Citizens United when Citizens United didn't even speak to this issue. So anyway, I appreciate the debate. Thank you for bringing me and Commissioner Ravel up to speed. Thank you.
And I appreciate that sometimes people are just going to disagree. So this may be one of those days. Any further discussion? Commissioner Hunter?
I just want to make what I think is the obvious point that even if this goes down 3-3, we have the previous AOs, which still have 4 votes for, and don't say that Citizens United changes anything. And I think people are free to, obviously, to rely on those old advisory opinions.
That's a fair point, although it is... of course, the old advisory opinions don't say that Citizens United has an impact on them because Citizens United hadn't been decided then. But, you know, the old advisory opinions say what they say. Mr. Vice Chairman?
Is there no motion on the other side?
Nope.
Okay. Will you entertain a motion?
I would be happy to entertain a motion.
Okay. Madam Chair, with respect to advisory opinion request 2013-19, Yamaha Motor Corporation USA, I repeat, USA, I move that the Commission approve draft B of agenda document 13-51, subject to the edits that I raised at the table for footnote 1, and authorize the Office of General Counsel to make any necessary technical and conforming edits. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of Draft B of the Draft Advisory Opinion to Yamaha Motor Corporation in AO 2013-19 with the amendments discussed at the table by the Vice Chairman earlier and authorizing technical and conforming edits by the Office of General Counsel. Is there any discussion on the motion? If not, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? No.
No.
And the motion fails 3-3, with the Vice Chairman, Commissioners Hunter and Peterson voting in favor, and Commissioners Walther, Ravel, and myself voting against. I'm sorry, Mr. Tyson, 2 times was not the charm for you. We're pretty much in the same place that we were a year ago.
Understood, and thank you.
Thanks for being with us anyway. Mr. Palmer, are there any management and administrative matters we need to discuss today?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
In that case, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everybody.